Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 Degree Boiling Hot Water, straight from your kitchen tap. Mine does filtered water, and it also does sparkling filtered water too. All chilled, absolutely fantastic gadget. Love it. Can't recommend it enough. Go to cooker.co.uk to have a look at the different designs and styles and what you can buy and things. I recommend it. If you've got the money, you can afford it, I'd get one. Right, today, 15 questions to Angela Scanlon. Now, I like Angela. I've worked with her a bit. But I've been a bit ill this week. So what I decided to do was go to Wikipedia and just cheat with my intro. And blimey, stuff she's done. She's an Irish television presenter and broadcaster for RTE and the BBC. She initially broadcast on Irish television, presenting a number of programmes on RTE, including the documentary Oi Ginger in 2014. I wonder what that's about. Probably find out. Since 2016, she's appeared as a reporter on The One Show. I think she's actually presented it, hasn't she, rather than just being a reporter. She also co-hosts Robot Wars with Dara O'Brien in 2016. Scanlon worked as a stylist and a journalist before moving into television. She wrote for Tatler, Grazia Company, U Magazine, Saturday Times Style Magazine. That's a lot, isn't it? In 2001, Scanlon was a dancer with the O'Shea Irish Dance Company. She performed some stuff in USA, United States of America. In 2012, the Irish Times described Scanlon as one of the 10 Irish Instagrammers you need to follow. 2012's an early adopter, it's got to be said, so must talk to her about that. Scanlon was named as the one to watch by Vogue in 2013 and was cited in the Observer's regular Why We're Watching feature as the UK's new on-screen fashion queen. Actually, I remember all this stuff because, you know, knocking around in the TV industry as long as I have, I remember Angela coming along and everybody talking about her. It was like constant, who's getting Angela and what show is she on? And so she was definitely one to watch, as Vogue said. And at the moment she's working on Your Home Made Perfect and Your Garden Made Perfect, sort of VR virtual reality style show where they take the why am I telling you? It's her job to tell you. It's not my job to promote her work. It's her job to promote work. She's got a new book out as well, which I'm sure she'll talk about too. Let's meet her. Here's Angela Scanlon. Angela, hello. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you, Tim?
I'm very well, thank you. I've just been going through your... I've been a bit ill this week, so...
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
So I was lazy and I just went through your Wikipedia page to do the intro.
Don't believe everything on there.
Really? Because there's some amazing stuff. Hopefully we'll cover it. But yeah, the thing that I'm most intrigued about is the amount of times that you have been, the Vogue's one to watch and the Observer's, Why Are We Watching, and all that sort of stuff. And it's really weird because I remember back in the day, suddenly you appeared and everybody in TV was talking about you. I'm not sure if you're aware of this.
You
sort of crossed over, and then behind the scenes, all the producers and production companies and stuff and people I was working with, they were all like, Angela Scanlon. And you were like the big news. And I just wondered if there was pressure on you because I've never been big news.
I mean, I'm old news, obviously, now. Was there pressure is the question. Well, I wasn't aware of those kind of questions, but of those conversations and that idea that I was, the one to watch. Obviously, I was, like, from paper cuttings, but that was a bit more like in fashion terms. And that was a nonsense, really. So it's not like it really played into anything. But I definitely was aware of when there was a shift for me. And it was actually after I got Robot Wars. And when I did The One Show, and suddenly it was like, oh, hang on, I'm not the kind of, dark horse, seeing how I get on. It was like I had something to lose now. There had been a kind of point where it was like, oh, yeah, OK, she can get the gig now. We trust her to take the gig. And then there was the pressure of, will I fuck it up?
Well, what's interesting, though, is I remember having a chat with someone. I won't mention their name here, but I'll tell you afterwards. But they had to phone me up and they said, what do you think of Angela? And you've been doing bits and bobs. And I said, I think she's really good. She's natural. She's like, because there's a, you know, we know our industry. There's a lot of people who turn up and they just chance it. And you do need, I mean, I know you do need a bit of talent to do presenting and stand there and do live. I think people, because it's the pivoting celebrity now, I think everybody thinks all you got to do is be famous and you can just present. But the reality is, if you want to pull off something live like the One Show, you have to have a bit. And as we can see, as they keep putting these new hosts on the One Shows, some of them are, I mean, they all become quite good in the end, but they're all wooden as hell to begin with.
It's a really tricky thing. And look, you know, if it looks easy, that's like the kind of easier it looks, obviously, the more skilled generally the person is. But I think everyone thinks they can do it. And I found it extremely daunting. From a technical perspective, when I first started doing live, I had no experience whatsoever. And, you know, obviously you kind of can't really gain live experience without doing live telly. So it's a tricky one. But I was paired with Matt Baker at the time, so he was able to kind of steer the ship. And in the early days, I had no idea that he was making U-turns or that he was kind of compensating for me over running in certain areas. So I think it's good when you have a pairing like that, because there's very little room for maneuver. But sometimes I can also find that a bit suffocating, and I quite like, I mean, Sunday Brunch is a perfect example. It feels, because it's a longer show, it feels like there's room for it to be actually live.
Yeah, I remember.
Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with you. I did the lottery once. It's the biggest audience I ever had. It was 2012, because it was the lead up to the Olympic Games. They got me in to do some lotteries.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many people watching the lottery at the time, but it was a huge amount, and it was a big deal. And yet it was the most boring gig I ever did, because they, you know, you're interviewing Sebastian Cohen, you've got two questions. And I'm like, what? Like, how can I ad-lib? And in the rehearsals, because you rehearse the hell out of it, they kept saying, I kept ad-libbing, and they were like, can't really ad-lib, Tim. It's all about Lady Godiva or whatever the machine was called. I don't even remember what the machine's called. And it's all that, and we don't know how long it will take. And the only interesting bit was, they said, we don't know how long the balls will take. So you'll either have a minute goodbye, like a 30-second goodbye or a 15-second goodbye. And I thought, well, that's the bit which excites me, the idea that I have to actually use my abilities, limited as they are, to get us out on time. And that's, you know.
Totally. And also, I think... like, just to the point of it being a skill, and everyone thinking that it's an easy thing to. And look, truth is, it's a great gig, isn't it? It's a lovely job to be able to do. But I remember my first job in TV, and it wasn't even on TV, but it was alongside The Voice, and it was a digital, doing the digital stuff in the background. And I had a meeting with the producer, and I had been kind of led to believe by the commissioner that I had gotten the gig. And so I met with the producer for what I thought was, like, you know, just an intro chat to get to know each other. And she was like, oh, yeah, so, you know, we're going to go with unidentified YouTuber. I was like, oh, this is not what I had anticipated this meeting to be about at all. I was absolutely gutted. I had so much kind of riding on this being like, it was the BBC. It was like a chance for me to show what I could do. And it stopped before it even started. And I remember, so I went to the bathroom to gather myself. I was like, at that point where I thought, you know what, I think I've given it as much as I can give. And I think maybe it's not meant to be. And I went into the loo, gathered myself, and I thought, you know what, I've nothing to lose here. And I came out and I said to her, look, here's what I think. You can go with a YouTuber who has however many million followers. I get it. Uh-huh. I understand the appeal. But I said, it's a different skill. I said, those people are used to talking about themselves in their room to one camera. I said, what you're dealing with are people who are the more nervous than they've ever been in their entire life. They've more to lose than they've ever had to lose in their entire life. And you need someone who can confidently and sensitively handle them at a really vulnerable point. And I said, if that's what you want, and if you recognize that that's the gig, then I think there's value in me doing it over a YouTuber. And I was like, I won't say anything else, but like, it's a skill that's different from talking to a camera. And she was like, okay, cool. Thank you. Yeah. Cheers. Thanks. And I got the gig. And I remember thinking, actually, it was kind of one of those points where I thought, oh, sometimes it is nice or worth doing what feels like slightly reckless thing in the hope that it comes off.
Do you know what? It's really weird. I was talking to an actor recently, and I met her on a tube, actually. And I said, oh, how are you doing? How's your show going? She's in the West End. And she was going, I hate it. And I said, why? And she goes, God, because we've got loads of like influencers in it. And they're like kind of actors, but they're actors with a big following type scenario type things.
Okay.
And I said, yeah. And goes, but they can't do the job. They're not just not very good. So, but we're sacrificing that for followers. And I just thought, you know, the public got themselves to blame. We've got ourselves to blame because we, you know, if you're going to busy watching the Kardashians, who's as far as I'm aware, don't have a talent, I don't think, unless I don't know what it is, but they just turn up and be themselves. And so, you know, if we were going to buy into all that sort of stuff, then that's what the way it's going with the industry. But interesting with TV presenting, because when I was at Sky Sports, they, you know, I had an agent and all the terrestrials would look at me. None of them would employ me until something for the weekend came along.
Yeah.
But none of them, but they sent me along for all these and they'd all audition me for any of the roles going. And I really wanted to have I love doing soccer, but I really fancied doing a gig on terrestrial TV as well.
Yeah.
And they all did exactly the same thing, which was right. You're just going to start, like, here's the auto cue or here's whatever, here's the cards and just keep presenting. And then, oh, by mistake, something would go wrong just to see how I could do it. Because there was a lot more live TV then. And it was just like, it was so obvious it was going to happen. It happened every single time. But they wanted to test to see whether you could actually do the gig. And nowadays, it's really funny. It hasn't worked like that. I'm not moaning, by the way, because I've got a lovely job, but it's a pivoting celebrity job now where they just, you know, oh, you used to be a tennis player. Great. Can you present TV shows or something? But it, you know, I don't know. Anyway, look, we want to get through these questions. So before we get on to that, tell us about your book. How's that going? That's exciting, isn't it? Being an author.
It's good. It is. It's quite like la-di-da. It feels weird to be introduced as an author, and I don't quite believe it, but I have that kind of sense with a lot of things in my life. It's called Joyrider, and it's about gratitude. And I know we've, you know, obviously spoken about it on your show, but it's something that I've kind of used time and time again to come back to keep me sane, really.
So it's sort of self-help book, is that the right way to describe it?
Self-development, I think. I mean, I love a self-help book. If you look at my shelves, it's literally the only thing I read. I'm not very good with fiction, and so I've always had an interest in maybe autobiographies, because they're obviously rooted in reality, or self-help / self-development books. That's what I listen to on podcasts. It's what I read, what I listen to in audiobooks. And that, it's just always, I mean, maybe that says a lot about what I've been yearning for a long time. But it was, I've always had an interest in kind of, you know, bettering myself, I suppose, for want of a better term, or fixing myself. And that's kind of where a lot of this came from, that kind of looking at what might sort me out.
Yeah, I've always thought about writing a book, but it's just the effort which goes into it. I had a book written for me once, a football book, and it was ghost written, and so I had other people write it for me, even though I was the one who got all the grief from it. But which is fine, but it does make me laugh.
And all the money, Tim.
But yeah, I did get the money as well, so I could take all the grief. But it does make me laugh, because every now and then it'll be book day, and this, like, there was some horrific reviews of it. I quite liked it, actually.
No.
I didn't mind it, and a lot of people said, "Oh, I like your book. It's the first one I've ever read," and kids and stuff like that. But now and then it comes up, and people go, "Look at the review of your book," and I always think it just makes me giggle a bit, because it's like, "Yeah, it was written by somebody else." But anyway, there you go. It's ghostwritten.
Sling like some shit at them, please.
Yeah, a lot of the books written out there are ghostwritten. But if I was going to write something again, I would write it 100% myself. Is it a hard process to write?
I have always loved writing, and I think I've got, I don't know whether it's, you know, I think I've got a particular turn of phrase. And so truthfully, I didn't even know, this sounds so naive and ridiculous, but I didn't know that ghostwriting was an option. For me, I assumed that was like, you know, you're in the big guns, like you're on tour, there's somebody in the bus with you, whatever it might be. It didn't even occur to me that was on offer. It wasn't. And I just don't think, I'm a bit of a control freak. I think it would be very obvious that it wasn't my voice. Although I've since spoken to a woman she's like, oh, you just put it together and then you can put your own voice on it, but they would structure everything. She says she turns around a book in 6 weeks, which was certainly shorter than my process. But actually the writing of it, I loved. I found it really cathartic, really therapeutic, kind of revisiting like areas of my life and things that had worked and things that hadn't worked and things that in hindsight I would have changed and things that I'm glad, you know, I went through. So it was you know, it was hardcore in parts, but I really enjoyed it actually. The editing I found horrendous.
What's that mean then?
Well, it just means that, so I assumed I'd write the book, hand it over, and then somebody who's much cleverer would tidy it up and make sense of it. And so I thought, oh, I handed in the book, handed it in, and they came back, they were like, brilliant, we'll be back to you. And they were like, great, go again. And I thought, what do you want me to do? And so it was literally go back and have another pass at it, which meant go back and figure it out yourself. And I was just not, I mean, I was done at that point. So that took a little bit more energy.
I've got to say though, the guy who goes wrote my football books is a great writer and he's a really good guy. I was lazy and that's why it turned out to be. I mean, I don't mind it actually, but it's why it turned out to be the way it was. Because I didn't.
But you know
He kept asking me, can we make some time? I was like, yeah, I'm busy. I'm being a TV presenter. I'm trying to be a celebrity.
I'm a big deal. I don't
know. Yeah, I am. Yeah. So, you know, I got a book deal, whatever, you know. And then we sort of had to panic and get it done in a. What I didn't realize was often sarcasm and things like that don't come across in print. And so, you know, some of it's tongue in cheek. And if you take it literally, it's just ridiculous. So,
but it's like when you do a press interview. I think that's why people love podcasts so much, is because if you say something with a wink, they can't put the wink in print. They often exclude the she laughed or the exclamation mark or whatever. So intonation is completely lost. And if you love a sarky old delivery, then you can sometimes say, like a dick.
Okay, look, your book is called Joyrider. I'm sure as we go through these questions, I'm going to start hammering through some of these questions with you. Come up some more. So what one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life? That's got to have come. Oh, no, really? It's not a piece of advice from your Joyrider book? Okay,
give us that just... should be. Yeah, no, I thought it was advice from somebody else. I'm not in sales.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Go on. Do that and then give our listeners some advice from your book. So go on. Just say yes. So, who gave you that?
Just say yes. My mother, actually, she used to always kind of say, you know what, just say yes and figure out how to do it later. And I always thought, oh, it's a bit risky and it's a bit cheeky. But it all actually, I think, there was a deeper it gave me permission to figure things out as I went, kind of to go, yeah, okay, there's a confidence on a base level from somebody who knows me implicitly that I can manage this. And so I think it's kind of stood to me pretty well career-wise. And also I think you should jump before you're prepared.
I did a podcast recently on luck. And the bottom line is people who say yes and open themselves up to opportunities are the ones who are lucky. So if you walk around going, yeah, I'll do that, I'll have a go, I'll have a look and I'll see. And they're the ones who get all the luck. The ones who sort of go, I'm not doing anything, I'm not coming out of my house, are the ones who don't get lucky. So
that combines with a little bit from the book, is that idea of perfectionism being such a like thing that stunts people from saying yes, because they're afraid to be seen or to be judged or to be criticized. And so you might have the opportunities, but you're too afraid to take them. And so you sit there, you know, criticizing other people and hating yourself for not doing
it. Go on then, expand. What is that bit in your book then?
It's exactly that. I spent years being like that kind of idea of perfectionism. And I thought it was quite, you know, cool to be a perfectionist. It made you, you know, like detail orientated and very exacting, but actually it's really debilitating and it's really shit because you do kind of, it's a protection thing. You've hide behind it. Nothing is good enough, which is essentially, I'm not good enough, you know? So you kind of go, no, 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 no. Conditions aren't right. People aren't right. Team isn't right, whatever it might be. And it's just a way of protecting yourself from failing or from realizing that you're not perfect, I think. And so I kind of last year, and the book was a big part of that, was like, do you know what? I'm going to do things that I don't feel 100% confident in, that I don't feel like I might not be the best at this, but I won't die. And actually, it's been quite liberating.
There's no such thing as perfection, really, is there? What's interesting about what you said there is that the amount of people I've interviewed, and everyone always says, who are the nasty ones? It's like, they're just very few. There's hardly any. But the ones who are arsy are the ones who don't trust their talent. So when you're really talented and you think you're, you know you're brilliant, you just waltz in. Like, interview a Beatle, they're so confident because they know they've got the back catalogue to back it up. But whereas, you interview someone and they haven't, then they're the ones who are like, where's my entourage? I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. All the ones who are great, they'll do anything they want because they know they've got the talent there.
But then some people have the talent and they don't have the self-belief. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think a lot of people who are extremely talented just, are driven from the wrong place and nothing is ever enough for them, and they turn it outwards.
Because I think part of the talent is the self-belief. Like, you look at someone like, I don't know, just for an example, football. Any footballer who's brilliant goes on the pitch and believes they're the best and they wander on there. They don't have, isn't that the same with acting?
But that's your perception, Tim. You don't know that person is not going, oh my God, they're going to find me out. I'm absolutely shit. That guy's better than me and his boots are cooler over there and he has a Nike deal and I don't have that one yet. It's our perception of people is wildly different from how they perceive themselves.
I don't believe that with the real talent. I don't believe that.
But what's real talent? Well, and your barometer really of it is different than the person's.
If you're really good at what you do, then...
But what does that mean?
Well, take your whatever profession you are. If you're an actor,
but like, do you have to have an Oscar to be really good as an actor?
No, you don't. But if you're comfortable with your talent, like if you're a great accountant, you'll walk into a room and go, "Give me the figures. Come on, give me those figures."
but I actually think that's really like to believe that everyone who's good at something has no sense of self doubt. I think makes people. And I think most of us who do have self-doubt in different situations feel like, oh, then we're not talented enough to do it. And actually, I think the truth is great people have self-doubt. They just push through it.
God, I'm going to have to go away and think about this. I'm just not. So if I was to say to you, right, you're a good presenter, Angela. If I was to say to you, like, I've got this show. I want you to present it. You know, it's going to be a live TV show. Saturday evening or something, BBC One, you're the presenter. Yeah. You're not going to go, I can't do that, are you? You're going to think,
absolutely
I can do it
because
you've got the talent.
I'll say 100% I will do that job. But I might not. I might think, how am I going to actually do this? So there's no doubt that in the run-up to that show, I'll go, I've talked myself into this really big gig. I think I know, like really deep down, I think I know I can do this. But then... those mad little voices in your head are like, are you kidding me? You got this job by luck. This is shit. Holly Willoughby would be much better at this gig. Claudia Winkleman would wipe your booth. Like, whatever it might be. It's unrealistic to believe that those voices, or else it's like wild discipline and well done to hear those voices and to be able to shut them down. But to believe that they don't exist in people who have talent, I think is naive, Tim.
Right, I'm gonna have to go away and have a think about this. I'm just not sure. Do you know what? If any of my listeners here, they're an expert in their field, obviously not the creative industries, the ones we're talking about. Like, you are an accountant and stuff. Are you? You're a coder. Do you just sit there oozing confidence? Or do you have self doubts as well? So if they asked me to present the news, I'd go, not a chance. I can't do that because.
But I bet you could. Yeah. That's like straight auto cue.
Honestly, I couldn't pronounce the words. That would be my first problem looking
it's
at all
killer
the
killer for me as well.
Rick Edwards is doing the Five Live breakfast, isn't he? And I just said to him, like, just as soon as all those words are coming through from, there's a war going in Ukraine and you've got to pronounce all those things because there's the pedantic people out there will pick you up and go, you're not pronouncing that correctly. You get people on my show, even if you pronounce Tirizzo wrong, people come and start having a go at you. Right, what's the best moment of your career so far, Angela?
Oh, best moment. You know what? I did a chat show last year in Ireland. It was like stopped pre-pandemic. And that was a real moment for me, actually. It was something that I kind of wanted to do for forever, quietly, because obviously it feels like a very big thing. And it was a very big thing. And I was absolutely FYI racked with self-doubt. But I loved it. And I think it's a lot of the time that's all the peripheral stuff. It's in the run up to it. And then when you're out there and you're, I guess, in flow and kind of live or as live will push you into that state anyway. But I love the doing of it. Sometimes all the stuff around it is excruciating for me.
It's really funny actually you say that, because just like I'm going to leave this topic in a minute, but when you get, like, as a TV presenter, when you get your list of guests on and it's got Angela Scanlon on it, you think, great, don't have to work, she'll deliver. You'll join in, the interview's going to be easy, everything's going to be easy because you're confident, you know what you're doing, boom, 100%. So easy, and that's what we get. You know, if anyone books me on a show, they know they're going to get somebody who's just going to keep banging on and talking because I'm trained to do it. So, it's interesting. And I know you'll make conversations. So the idea that you would have self-doubt about doing a chat show is weird to me. But I'm going to go away and think about it anyway.
Go away and have a good look at yourself.
But that was always the kid. That was always the thing that everyone wanted, wasn't it? A chat show. And bizarrely, Sunday brunch, I always wanted the Saturday evening chat show. They don't exist anymore. But they're like Graham Norton still does it, and he does a good job. But so things like Sunday brunch now are the modern day chat show, aren't they? Because if you want to go and talk about your product or something on a TV show, it's generally going to end up being pissing around in a kitchen on Sunday brunch.
100%. But also it's so loose and lovely. And what I wanted was a kind of slightly, where there was a bit of gamification about it and less about people coming on and plugging stuff, which in reality is a trickier thing when you're booking people. It's just that ability to sit and chat with somebody and connect with somebody. And I think that's what, that's certainly why I got into this. And that feels like the purest form of that, really. Although sometimes, we know that the truth is that, there are questions prepared. But this show was called Ask Me Anything. And so the guests were not pre-prepared with questions. And that was really important to me, because I remember doing a show, Shall Remain Nameless, and coming off air and the producer saying to me, please don't ever ask a question again that you don't know the answer to. And I was like, sorry? Is that not literally the point of a question? And obviously on live telly it's a slightly different thing, but it was such a mad sentence to hear out loud from one human being to another that I just thought, oh shit, maybe this is not for me, is it? Don't ask a question you don't know the answer to. I was like, wow, okay.
I shouldn't say this really because it'll probably go against me, but the biggest problem I've always thought with the TV industries is when you meet producers who want to be the presenter, because then they just, you've got to let the presenter, you've got to let the talent be the talent, otherwise, as they call the presenters in the industry, you've got to let them do their shit, otherwise it doesn't work. Right, I'm going to have to ask more questions, otherwise we're never going to get through these. What's the worst moment of your career?
Oh, worst moment of my career was when Robot Wars was axed. And not because, that doesn't happen. Shit happens and shows aren't renewed for loads of different reasons. And I was really, really proud of it. It happened, or I got the news 2 days after I had my first daughter. And it was like just in the moment where like the blues are kicking in. And it genuinely felt like a real grief. And they very kindly called to say, FYI, this is going to break, because it had been, a conversation for a long time. They'd made the decision and wanted to tell me, before it got picked up. I felt so wounding to me, so wounding. And I still have a really soft spot for that show and for that whole community. So that was a tricky one for me. And it was probably, like you saying that people had been chatting about me, and there was a kind of sense of this incline and things happening almost by magic, like this big BBC Two family entertainment show on a Sunday night. Like, it was beyond what I kind of, on paper should have had. And suddenly it was like, oh shit, we're done.
It's such a bizarre decision, isn't it? Because if any show can exist online with lots of people following and interacting, it's that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you could even show the guys building stuff constantly throughout the months and build up. I mean,
it's true, actually. Yeah. But they put it up against Blue Planet, which was like absolutely outrageous. But this is too, insider chat. But it's funny, I've recently joined TikTok. Don't shame me. Okay. It's a hideous decision, but we'll see how we go. And people Robot Wars people have loads of videos on there.
Have you got, were you involved in the show where, and I can't remember whether it was first time around or second time around, where the adult loses it with the kids?
We covered it on Sunday Brunch.
Oh, did we?
Yeah, we did, yeah. Ant was his name. And was beaten by, Glitterbot, I think the name of the robot was. And it didn't go down well. Although, yeah.
Talking about TikTok, I read in the intro that the Irish Times described Scanlan, you, as one of the 10 Irish Instagrammers you need to follow in 2012. That's really early adopting for the Instagram.
I plateaued.
Did you? But were you? That's pretty early, isn't it, to be doing that in 2012?
That was pretty early. You'd think I'd have grown a bit more, wouldn't you? Yeah, it was. I think I have this weird ability. I think I start things really early, and then when they get a bit mainstream, I'm like, or when people expect things of me, I'm like, no, there's a rebellious streak in me. So just when I should be cashing in, I lean out.
Is that the same with when you worked as a stylist then? Are you good at spotting the trends happening?
Yeah, I think so. Now, you might not remember this, but my very first TV gig in the UK was on Sunday Brunch.
I do remember, yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember.
The dress with the peppers on it. And the like knitted trainers.
I remember the knitted stuff. But you were given that item, weren't you?
Yeah, I was given that item. Mm. Yeah. And it didn't last for very long. I mean, it lasted for one segment, which I imagine was around 6 minutes. And I never got the call back. But,
well, what was interesting about that was because it was right at the birth of Sunday Brunch, and
exactly.
I was thinking about this today actually because I knew I was going to speak to you, and you were, well, I was asked. I had quite a lot to do with the show in those days, as
of course.
In you know that we were guiding it, and they said, "What do you think about doing an item like you know spotting trends and stuff?" I said, "I think it's a brilliant idea."
Yeah.
And so you came on, and after the show, I thought it was brilliant. I really liked it. And then for some reason it didn't come back. And I was like, why is this not coming back? And I think it had something to do with the identity of the show had to be different from something for the weekend.
Yeah, okay.
And it was something to do with two men and not having any women presenting it or something because of there was some sort of dispute between BBC and Channel 4. I think it was something. But my memory's so dodgy about that.
I think you're right. They were trying to do like a little format point changes. And look, maybe it felt like, oh, here we have the token woman talking about dresses. And that was like, who knows? And I don't think that was the idea of the item and had it grown into something. But perhaps that was what it was kind of recognize that, who knows.
You were put on to spot trends, and I loved that idea because I wanted to do that. I constantly wanted to make the show like a Sunday color supplement, and people wouldn't let us because I wanted to do movies and I wanted to just do all that sort of stuff.
Love that, but maybe I was too close. I was too much in that fashion space maybe at the time. But anyway, That's a long, long time. I don't know how many. It must be 10 years ago. So what I probably
Exactly 10 years ago, because it was our anniversary.
It was 10 years ago,
yeah.
10 years of Sunday Brunch. Catchy.
But I think, it's such a shame that didn't work, because I think that was a really good idea.
Yeah, so. It was fun.
All right, next question. Oh, go on, sorry.
No. I was just going to say, it's actually really good. Like, that kind of thing is resilience. I remember somebody saying to me, TV, it's last one standing, and you're going to get knocked down and you're going to get like rejected. And it feels like, even Robot Wars felt like, oh my God, I'm never going to come back from this. And then you do. And if you don't, you're in the wrong gig anyway.
Yeah, but that's a really weird one, because I remember I liked it and I can't remember that. But it only takes one person at the channel or something to go,
I'll tell you off air after what happened.
Okay, good. Because I'm intrigued by that. All right. Yeah. What does success mean to you?
Oh, do you know what? This is a bit of a fluffy one, but I have struggled forever with this. It's part of the reason I wrote the book, is because I was always living in the next thing, next like tick off the list. And success was always a kind of constantly moving goalpost. So I'd write down a list of things that I wanted to do, and then I'd get to them, and then they wouldn't really do much for me at all. So now I think that success is being able to enjoy the process, not just the like the end result. And I mean, I say that like I've figured it out. I haven't. But it's what I try to do, is to kind of remain like in the present and remind myself that this is the gig. This is the gig, not in 2 years' time or in 2 months' time when that thing happens. It's now. And if I can't squeeze some amount of enjoyment out of the now, then I'm never going to feel it in that future moment.
I think that's such a wise thing. That's full of wisdom, that, because that's exactly how I lived my life for years, always thinking, what's the next thing? When am I going to arrive? Everyone always thinks there's a finish line, and there is no finish line. So you have to enjoy the process. Your book is about, I'm just reading the front here, how gratitude can help you get the life you really want. It is about that, isn't it? It's about enjoying it and showing gratitude to the world, and just actually desiring what you have and not what you want all the time. It really
exactly helps. That, and I do think social media can be a kicker for that, like, because it's obviously a part of the human condition to look around and to try and better yourself next to, you know, or in relation to somebody beside you or in the village or whatever it is. But social media has meant that that's just become so prevalent and so constant that actually none of the things that you do can ever live up or match up to this sea of people you're surrounded by every single day. So you've got to, I think, quite consciously look at what you have instead of what other people have.
I did a podcast with Oliver Burtman, who wrote a book called 4,000 Weeks, which is about time, basically, and that's how long you're alive for. And one of the chapters in it, which is fantastic, is the fear of missing out. And he says, in this day and age, it is absolutely impossible not to miss out, because you have so many options. You've got so many choices. I mean, there's no need for you to be sitting here now. You could be in Barcelona. You've got the means to do it. You could be, I don't know, you could be in Florida. You could be up a mountain somewhere in the Alps. You could be doing whatever you want. So you're always missing out, because the opportunities are endless for you. Whereas our grandparents, they didn't have very many opportunities. And our children are going to have even more opportunities. Yeah. And so they're always living in FOMO. And that's why you have to, I'm not a self-help guru, but one of the things I have learned is desire what you have and not what you want, and then it's just that little flip where you look around the house and go, oh, really good, I've got a chair.
I've got 100%. TV. And I talk about joyriding, that idea and that concept of, like, of waking up and going, oh, this mattress is gorgeous, I'm so lucky to wake up in a bed, you know. And to kind of allow that momentum to build. But I do think that FOMO thing is interesting, because I like missing, you know, people or things or like events or opportunities is a really painful thing to get in touch with, I think. So I, for a long time, was like under this delusion that I did, if I just worked hard enough and like stretched myself thin enough, I would never have to miss out on anything. I could do all of the things. And like the quality that you bring to each of those is completely compromised, whether that's your personal life or your professional life. And so I think recognizing like your limits as a human and going, okay, missing out on things is a given. It's a privilege, but it's also a pain in the arse, and it's painful sometimes. And you're like, I can't do everything. I can't be in two places at the one time.
And I think society gives women a hard ride. I'm probably going to regret saying this, because I'll probably be clumsy and muck up, but I think women are told to be, you know, they've got to get ahead in work, they've got to go and get a career, then they've got to be a super mom whilst they're doing yoga, eating healthily, but they've also got to be a party animal. There's not enough room for, and I think you know, the women I know in my life and stuff, a lot of them have really struggled with, the child comes along and suddenly they can't do, they're tired and they don't want to do the work and and it happens to men as well. We're asking a lot of men these days too, and you know, there's only so much time, 24 hours in a day, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I think there's a lot of pressure on women with things like Sex in the City and stuff. You can have it all.
Yeah.
You're actually going to exhaust yourself a lot if you try and have it all.
And it's a delusion. It's impossible. You can't have it all. And most of the time people portray this image that they have it all without any support whatsoever. So, you know, you can't have it all. You can have lots of this stuff. And I have, you know, I think it's amazing to attempt to have all of the stuff if that's what you're into. But, you know, you also need support doing that. You know, whether that's in a partner or whether that's in asking for help or being able to afford you know, support, but that's also you're still missing out on things. Yeah. You know, you can't do everything. So I think it is being realistic about the sacrifices that you make for one thing over the other.
Okay, I'm not conscious of your time, and I want to ask, this is my favorite question I ever ask anyone, so I'm going to ask it early.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Oh, so this was really odd one to me, Tim. I was like, that came left of field.
Because I'm obsessed with aliens, as in I don't okay. believe in them, but I like reading about them. I like reading about time travelers. I like reading about any of that stuff. So
okay,
yeah, so I'm intrigued.
So like sci-fi kind of situation.
Yeah, but I've never seen a ghost and I've never seen a UFO. I think I'm unlucky because lots of people yeah. have. You know, Sean okay. Ryder has.
Okay, I'm delighted for him. This is not exactly an answer to your question, but I did see a levitating caterpillar the other day and I thought, is this an alien? And I was like, I put my hand over it and was like, is that, you know, a cobweb yeah. kind of that's holding it up? I took a video, I'll send it to you. And I thought, this is really very odd. So maybe it was an alien. I don't think it was. However, I do believe in like spiritual signs. So not necessarily ghosts, but I 100% believe that my granny, who died like many, many years ago, I'm going to say probably 30 years ago, like is around me in the form of a robin. I know I sound absolutely mental, but like a robin, there is this robin. Every time, everywhere I go, there's a robin there. And like, I'm pretty sure that it is Dolly, my granny. And I don't say that like as a piss take. I really, really do believe that. And I believe in angel numbers. I see numbers everywhere. So I believe in like the universe giving you a little nod to go, you know, you're on the right track, or have a little think about that.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why was you?
Oh, interesting. Says the dude what? Who believes in UFOs. Go on.
I actually don't believe in UFOs, but I like reading about them because okay. I'd like to. I just love it in our lifetime if they went, yeah, by the way, there's aliens and UFOs. And they, you know, yeah. they might even be coming to kill us, but at least I would find out. I would like that. But she's chosen a robin. I'm not sure the lifespan of a robin. It's quite.
I don't know. But you see, here's the thing. That's what you're concerned with, how bound we are by like, you know, timelines.
Yeah.
But actually, I'm thinking she could be in, you know, inhabit multiple robins. That's just how she shows up to me. You know?
She just jumps around robins saying hello.
Time hopping. Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to what other jobs did you do? And I'm gonna steer you towards, you were an Irish dancer, because I want to know about that. So you yeah. were in the O'Shea
Irish Dance Company,
and you went all the way to United States of America performing.
Yeah. Yeah, we went to America. We went all around Europe. Like I used to do it when I was in school. And in the summer holidays, we'd go to these like weird kind of festivals, folky kind of festivals with people from all over the world. I remember going to one in Concarneau in France once. And I'm now afraid. I'm like, no, it's fine. So there was at the time, all of these we call them dance, like a troop or tribes, whatever. And so we were obviously the Irish gang. There was a Scottish crew there who all had like kilts on and did traditional Scottish dancing. And then there was a tribe from the Pygmies. And
wow.
we, like unbelievable. And we would be in the canteen, thousands of us getting whatever, you know, ox tongue. And they would do different delicacies every day. And you'd have to eat whatever you were given. And like all of the women, as is their culture, were topless.
Blimey.
And they, so we were kids and we'd be
were they small?
Lunch. Tiny, right. tiny. And like boobs down to their waist. And
how did
like,
they dance? Was it like, what was the
they, like,
was
there was
the,
a lot,
style?
I mean, oh, like a lot of, I was gonna, like feet banging, like very kind of chanting, and they had little skirts on them. I mean, this is now again 20 years ago, but I just remember it was such an amazing, having come from like a little country village in Ireland to sit and eat with people from such wildly different walks of life.
That's amazing. Whereabouts in Ireland did you come from?
Meath. So outside Dublin. So like an hour from Dublin, but yeah, in the countryside.
I toured with the Chieftains once. I used to be a swagman, flogging T-shirts
and I danced with the Chieftains.
Did you? Because what were you a solo dancer with them?
So we did. They composed a piece of music that we choreographed a dance to as a tribute for Michael Flatley, Mental, and then we danced it for years to come. So no, I didn't tour with them like the way Gene Butler would have done and Flatley back in the day.
But who's Gene Butler? Because
Butler was the original river dancer.
Oh right, okay. So I toured and there was an American lady who danced at the front of the stage doing Irish dancing.
Yeah, that was her, redhead.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah, Jean Butler.
Oh, she was cool. She was nice.
Yeah, she's fabulous. She's amazing. So elegant.
I did a few gigs. But what I found amazing about it is, like, Ireland is so popular for being Irish, isn't it? It's like such a. Do you know what I mean? There's no sort of like touring English stuff, is there? Do you know what I mean? It's like the island's like this amazing place where you've got the music, the dancing, the Guinness and everything. And you take it out and the crowds who came were so in love with Ireland. It was just, it was an amazing thing to watch. You were saying they're in love with Ireland,
like it's just the countryside. And then you name the music and the dance and the like, food and the drinks. So it's like there's quite a bit that makes up that. It's not just Ireland for the sake of Ireland. It's like actually based and built on talent.
That's what I mean. It's such an amazing thing though. It's amazing that it carries on existing. That's what's fantastic about
it. I know.
Because a lot of it, you know, I mean, I'm not sure the Scottish scene, some fire. I'm going to stop.
Back away, Tim.
Let's talk about pygmies instead.
I was a bit nervous in that territory myself.
Yeah, it's terrible being a presenter these days, isn't it? You want to get involved in a conversation, and then you know, like, all right, okay. I think we've got time for one more question. So
yeah, go.
I know you've got to go because you've got to go and pick your kids up from school. So, one of your kids. Let's do. What were you like at school?
Oh, what was I like at school? I was clowny. Weirdly, and this kind of ties back to the Irish dancing thing. Primary school, loved. Secondary school, not so much. I was kind of very involved in dancing, and that was like the place where I went to escape, where I went to express myself, where I had like that was my little crew. And school was like, oh God, I'd quite like to get out of here. And I really wanted at the time to leave, to go to Riverdance, to tour professionally. And it was just not... It didn't go down well, and I was never able to do it. I did it while I was in university, but my parents, you know, were kind of quite conservative, and they were like, absolutely not. You are not parking like a university education so you can go flute around drinking and then break your leg and end up back here with what? And so I didn't do that. And, you know, I'm glad, I think.
Is there money to be made out of it then, the Irish dancing? I follow these two kids. I call them kids. These two brothers. They're called the Gardner Brothers.
Oh, do they have, like, put a plank on like, the roadside? Oh, I love them.
They're so amazing. Good, aren't they?
Yeah, I follow
them because I really enjoy watching Irish dancing. I really like the music. There's a pub up the road from me, and they do trad music every Friday. Oh, yeah. And I haven't been actually since the end of the lockdown, but prior to COVID, I used to go there on a Friday night. And basically, people just turn up. It's really famous, this pub. So people turn up from all over Ireland. You know, if they're visiting London or whatever, they go there, and they just play the trad music in the corner, and it is absolutely the best night ever.
Yeah,
that word you use is magic. It's a little bit of magic in here if you're drinking a Guinness. You got a packet of crisps,
and also it's the ride that you go on, because I do think the kind of, like, you know, the charm, the like openness that you get with Irish people is mirrored by like quite a depth of sensitivity and pain, and so that comes out and bursts through the music, and you're like, oh Jesus, I don't know where I'm going, and I'm net, you know, the parting glass, and people are weeping literally, and then you're like straight into a jig, and it's joyful, you know. So it's a real mix. I do some work with the Irish Centre, and there was a gig there. It was just pre-lockdown. Oh my God, it was unbelievable. Amazing Irish musicians. Maverick Sabre was there. Imelda May. Have you ever had Imelda on the show?
Yeah, she's been on the show. Yeah, she's brilliant. Yeah,
she's unbelievable. And she sang. There was like you could hear a pin drop, and it's just this kind of almost like hauntingly open. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I love it, and you sometimes forget it. And in a way, I think being over here, you know, having moved over here and feeling kind of rooted here now to a degree, I'm now able to see it with like fully open eyes and really appreciate how incredible like my that culture is, I suppose. I feel very lucky.
Come to my local pub when you get a chance, because it is absolutely brilliant in there. I have such good, and they don't have to have any sort of speakers or anything. It's just them in the corner of the room doing it, and everyone enjoying themselves. Final thing before you go: what is the meaning of life?
Oh fuck! The meaning of life is. Oh God, is this like a one word or a philosophical?
Well, you've got to go and pick your daughter up.
Okay, I think it's connection. It's connection. Oh. I think we are afraid of it for the how open it makes us feel. We yearn for it. We're looking for it all the time. It's what fuels us. It's what feeds us. And we kind of, it takes real bravery, I think. And real guts to like fully connect with people, because it's easier to fly solo, I think, a lot of the time. So yeah, to me, it's that ability to be unafraid in connecting with humans when you know one is going to die.
Angela, thank you so much for joining me today. I like that. Your book is called Joy Rider, and you can follow it at all the normal places. Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed that. We should do it again soon.
Definitely.
We'll gossip about the industry together.
Yeah.
Cheers, Angela. Thank you.
Bye.